Good morning, everybody. Can I welcome everyone here? My name is Anthony Giddens. I'm a director of the London School of Economics. On behalf of the LSE and the organizations sponsoring this event, let me welcome you to today's conference. I didn't think you could get a more appropriate venue for the conference than the London School of Economics. This is probably the largest and most inclusive conference of its kind for many, many years. It's also, I think, the most exciting time in British politics for at least two decades. I'm sure that everyone here will find the events of the day both instructive and absorbing, and I now turn to Helena Kennedy to tell you more about them in detail. Thank you.
Well, welcome. This conference, Passing the Torch, has been organized jointly by Nexus and the Guardian newspaper, but in association with the Fabian Society. Needless to say, the timing was not accidental. With only weeks to go before what is likely to be an historic election, there could be no better moment to discuss and debate key themes which will shape the challenge to 18 years of Tory rule. All of us must be hoping that this election will usher in a new era of progressive politics. As Tony has just said, it is an exciting and inclusive conference. It's the biggest ever gathering of the British centre-left in recent history. There are over 1,000 delegates going to attend this conference. It's a tribute to the growing intellectual confidence of the centre-left that this is happening. It shows the strength of commitment of the activists and thinkers who are propelling us forward. This event, I think, symbolises a mood for change in the country. The Tories couldn't, I think, stage a similar event. They would not be able to get people to share platforms, probably. The divisions are so great. But I think it's probably about more than that. The New Right's political project has, it seems, ground to a halt. So, to paraphrase John F. Kennedy, the time has come to pass the torch to a new generation of British politicians, a new generation of political thinkers and activists who possess the values, the ideas, and the energy to confront and overcome the challenges facing Britain as we approach the new century. Now, the conference has been made possible only by the hard work and commitment of many, many organisations, and you can see that from the nature of the workshops and sessions that are being put on. They have contributed considerably to the running of those sessions, and you'll be attending them for the rest of this day. If you haven't signed up for a particular session, do not panic. Choose the one you fancy and just go along there. There is a conference desk at the front of the main LSE building near the Porter's Lodge. If you have any difficulties in finding anywhere or in finding out any information that you want, go back to that registration desk and you'll get your help there. Can I just mention that the Guardian newspaper has produced, and it's available today, their election guide, and it's available on the Guardian stall upstairs. And just finally, there is a Nexus online demonstration taking place in the main building, St. Clement's building, in room S185, and anyone who would be interested in going along, it's apparently fascinating, so get yourself along there, pop in and have a look at it during the lunchtime. Can I just tell you about our speakers? They're all familiar to you. We have Professor John Gray, whose writing I'm sure all of you are familiar with. He's been a very important thinker and intellectual source of enrichment for us. And he is here to speak to you today. Lord Jenkins, who needs no introduction at all, the leader of the Liberal Party in the House of Lords, a man who whose political background will be familiar to everyone. He was the former leader of the SDP, he was a Labour Shadow Chancellor and Home Secretary, and President of the European Union. A man of letters as well as a politician. He's currently the Chancellor of Oxford University. Joining us in the course of this session will be Tony Blair, the leader of the Labour Party, and he will be our final speaker. So can I introduce Lord Jenkins, please?
Mrs. Kennedy, ladies and gentlemen, this, as I understand it, is a conference about how we can best ensure that we do not wake up on the morning of May the 2nd to the dreadful anticlimax of another Tory government. And well beyond that, on tolerable terms to all concerned, we can heal the split in the centre-left, which, dating back at least to 1918, and maybe well before that, has done so much, in spite of the isolated bursts of sunshine in 1906, 1945, and maybe 1964 and 1966, has done so much to make the 20th century a Tory century in the way that the 19th century never was. That does not begin to mean that I or the other SDP secessionists of 1981 come before you in a penitential shift. There were differing ways in which the Social Democrats in the Labour Party, previously in the Labour Party, reacted to those dreadful excursions around the wilder shores of political lunacy which characterized the first years after the 1979 defeat. Some Social Democrats certainly managed to fight the 1983 election with its longest suicide note in history manifesto. Not my phrase, but Gerald Kaufman's, you'll remember. As some of them managed to fight as Labour candidates, but only, as it were, in dark spectacles, with the collar of their raincoat turned up and the brim of their hat pulled down. Some others were very young. And some blazed an alternative trail, which has had its ups and downs, but whose class-unifying rather than class-dividing radicalism has, I believe, provided some of the guidelines for new Labour. Nor do I believe that the Liberal Democratic Party has become remotely redundant. As a matter of hard fact, I and others who think like me are not going to change parties again. To do so once is traumatic, but understandable, can be rewarding. But to do so twice, to paraphrase Oscar Wilde's Lady Bracknell, would point not so much to carelessness as to ridiculousness. That, however, does not preclude a merger when it is a marriage of true and settled minds, as in the 1988 SDP-Liberal merger. But it does preclude a habit of party hopping. I also believe that an independent Liberal Democratic Party can contribute some ideological stimulus. I, of course, greatly welcome many of the changes which have recently come to the Labour Party. I welcome the new mood of financial responsibility. As the Chancellor, not the Shadow Chancellor, Helena, but the Chancellor of 1967 to 70. I wished at the time it had been Shadow Chancellor. But as the Chancellor of those years, how could I say otherwise? And well past those self-indulgent but electorally wrecking cruises along those wild shores. This is right. but one also wants a touch more excitement than just a cruise around the harbour in the Skylark. In particular, speaking not only as a former Labour Chancellor, but as a former Labour Home Secretary, twice so indeed, I recommend that when financial stringency is necessary, it should be leavened by a robustly radical and libertarian approach in areas where money is not primarily at stake. The Liberal Democrats, I'm well aware, do not carry the central, the awful responsibility, awful in the literal sense of the word, which rests on the Labour Party, and above all on the Labour leader, for ensuring that the Tories do not win their fifth election victory coming. But a confident Labour Party, in the spirit of the market economy, which is so fashionable today, should welcome a little radically stimulating competition on its flank. It is also the case that the Liberal Democrats, geographically and in some other ways, can reach into some political potential anti-Tory parts where others cannot get. I congratulate the Labour Party on its crushing Wirral victory. It was crushing, crushing of Tory hopes, not so much because of the size of the swing as because of the size of the turnout. From a defeat with a 50% turnout, recovery is much more possible than from a defeat with a 73% turnout. I do not, however, believe that the low, allowing the circumstances, not so low, Liberal Democrat vote any more makes us nationally irrelevant than the equally low or lower Labour votes in Newbury and Christchurch made the Labour Party irrelevant. The electorate, without being specially told, perhaps indeed the more so, if not told by politicians, has a considerable capacity to vote not with its feet, but with its brain. Therefore, I have a certain calm confidence about a Tory defeat on May the 1st. That the horrors of the reverse happening should make us eschew any complacency or premature triumphalism. Just think of the smug self-satisfaction of Mr. Major, or the obstreperous antics of Mr. Michael Heseltine, if by chance the result were another Conservative victory. And it would be a Conservative government, a Tory government, without any breaks or inhibitions, for it would have been demonstrated that there was no limit to how badly and partisanly you can govern and still be re-elected. Furthermore, it would effectively be the end of the tradition of changing governments, which is the bedrock, insofar as there is a bedrock, of British constitutional practice. It would also be the end of the politics of hope in Britain. For if the centre-left cannot win this spring, I do not see how we can ever win. And that would mean to take two totally disparate questions. One, the effective end, the great institution of an independent public service working impartially for governments of different colours. And secondly, a grave threat, as Mr. Major has pushed further and further into a narrow English chauvinism, to the union with Scotland. A Tory victory would thus offer far more threat to the best elements in the British political system than anything which comes from Brussels. So, any Liberal Democrat with his head screwed on must recognize that the only way to avoid these evils is a Labour government on May the 2nd, with Mr. Blair in Downing Street. Although I strongly hope, with a large Liberal Democrat element within the anti-Tory majority in the House of Commons. But what about the election in 2001 or 2002? I firmly believe that the damage of 18 years of conservative hegemony cannot be undone by anything less than a minimum of 10 years of centre-left government. And I think the essential root to this is a measure of mutually satisfying cooperation between the Labour Party, with perhaps 45% of the vote, 48% if it's lucky, and the Liberal Democrats' cooperation, which could give it the prize, the moral authority, unprecedented at least since the war, achieved not even in 1945, of a government with the effective support of well over 50% of those voting. And I must add a measure of electoral reform, which is not only the key to this, but the only guarantee of never again undergoing 18 years or anything like it of minority Tory governments elected on a minority of the vote, crowing from the top of a false majority in the House of Commons. I believe that the public mood would welcome a certain loosening of party ties and party frontiers. We and they have had too much of what I call tabernacle politics, the view that all within are saved and all those outside are irremediably damned. Ideas have even more importance than party whips, and if we can agree, as I think we can, on at least some of them, let us not be ashamed to say so.
Can I now introduce to you John Gray, Professor of Politics at Oxford. In his many books and articles, John has charted the decline of the New Right and has explored the shape of the new centre-left project. His book, Enlightenment's Wake, is truly wonderful, and I recommend it to you. And so can I have John? Can I also apologise to you, Roy, for forgetting that you were there as a Chancellor? One's become so used to putting the word shadow in front of anybody decent.
No need to apologise.
John Gray.
No need to apologise. Gave him my best cheers.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. We meet today as we near a moment of historic transition. For 18 years, we've been ruled by the economic and political philosophy of the New Right. We've been the subject of an ideological experiment in neoliberal social engineering. Now, I take it that it's evident to all of us here, as it is to the majority of the British people, that that experiment was misconceived, that it has failed miserably, and that it has failed at great human cost. The economic renewal for which so much has been sacrificed has not occurred. National economic decline has not been halted or slowed. It has continued. At the same time, the fabric of society has been torn, and many of our institutions have been hollowed out. The old left, with which the new right has so much in common, used to say that you can't have an omelette without breaking eggs. In Britain, over the past 18 years, a great many eggs have been broken, but the omelette is still nowhere in sight. The new right promised a great deal. It claimed to possess the key to economic regeneration for Britain. By reducing the size of the state, economic efficiency and individual freedom would be maximized. If governments followed a couple of simple nostrums, if it moves, privatize it. If it cannot be privatized, then inject markets into it. Enhanced wealth and greater choice would follow inexorably. But the increase in wealth and choice promised by the new right would occur only on one condition. Concern for social cohesion and social justice, ideals that have always been at the heart of the British centre-left, and which used to inform one nation Tory traditions as well, those ideals had to be given up. They were obstacles to economic renewal. They must be removed from the agenda of British debate. The new right told the British people that a commitment to social justice was harmful to the creation of wealth. It told us that we need not worry about social cohesion. Government ought not to concern itself with the common good. The common good did not exist. There are only the interests and choices of individuals. Politicians should not seek to forge and embody a social consensus on values. Government must not seek to articulate and implement the moral common sense of the British people. For government to attempt any of these tasks was unnecessary and even dangerous. Nor did government have a significant role in enabling individuals to achieve their aspirations. If people were freed to pursue their own interests in the marketplace, nothing more should be asked of government. Needs met in the past by public services should be met in future by markets. The ideal of the new right was a minimum state. Freedom was not exercised by having a voice in decisions that affect us, or by exhibiting loyalty to communities and institutions to which we belong. Freedom meant the negative freedom of exit and nothing else. In this new right philosophy, the proper role of government was restricted narrowly to a few institutions and activities. Law and order, the enforcement of contracts, national defence, possibly poverty relief. Government had no obligation to open up opportunities, to ensure fairness, to assist communities, or to enable people to cope better with change and insecurity. It had no responsibility to give a helping hand to individual aspirations or to nurture life in communities. When it freed up markets, it had done all it can or should try to do as a government. Now, I don't think I caricature this new right philosophy or exaggerate the power it's had in the making of public policies. It's informed the thinking of four successive Tory governments on nearly every issue of public policy. And, more than ever before, it animates the Tory party today. It has practically driven out from the Conservative Party the one nation thinking that influenced it benignly in the past. It provides the basis for the programme of hiving off public services which the Conservatives will undoubtedly implement if they have a fifth term in which to carry yet further their experiment in social engineering. So the last 18 years have been ruled by a single ruinous project, the project of attempting to achieve economic renewal without regard or concern for social cohesion. That project was based on the conviction that an harmonious society would come about as an automatic result of new right economic policies. Nothing in historical experience or in the world we know today supports this claim. Freeing up markets and leaving communities to their own devices has divided society. In Britain, it has created a neoliberal dependency culture of people who have been excluded from access to work. It's resulted in 1 in 5 non-pensioner householders in Britain having no working members, a level of exclusion that's unique among European countries. It's left our cities desolate and unsafe. It's de-skilled much of the workforce. These are not conditions that make for social cohesion or for economic success. The conviction that a cohesive society will arise automatically from new right economic policies is not the true core of the new right project. At bottom, the New Right believes that economic efficiency and social cohesion are alternatives. They are rival values between which we are forced to choose. This belief shaped the era of the New Right. That era, the era of the New Right, is over. Ethical socialists and social liberals have always known that the idea that economic success could be founded on a fractured society is an illusion. Building a dynamic market economy demands more, much more, than government non-interference in the life of business. It requires a well-educated and highly motivated workforce, good infrastructures, and high-quality public services. The New Right talks a great deal about competitive markets. Its view of them, though, is almost entirely negative. All that's needed for a competitive, innovative economy is that the state should get out of the way. But a modern market economy is not what's left over when mistaken and ineffective policies of state intervention have been given up. A dynamic modern market economy is a complex cultural, legal, and social institution. If it's to flourish, it needs to be supported by well-conceived public policies. Let's not forget that the New Right was highly successful in mobilizing both political and intellectual support for its nostrums. How did it do this? The post-war Labour governments had many brilliant achievements to their credit. Yet the New Right was able to be as successful as it was, partly because in the 70s and 80s, the old left confused means with ends. The common good was equated with collective provision through the institutions of an overextended state. Government attempted to manage the economy by corporatist practices and policies. The purpose of welfare institutions was identified with the relief of poverty rather than with improving skills and opportunities. Redistribution was advanced as a means of compensating those who were poor because they lacked skills and opportunities. Some public services were imbued with a paternalist ethos that was insensitive to individual preferences and personal aspirations. The old left equated concern with the common life of society with support for collective state structures. This was a mirror image of the doctrines of the New Right. In this, as in several of their beliefs, the old left and the New Right were at one. Both believed that individual aspirations and the common good were at odds. Each denied a truth that centre-left thinkers have long recognised, that individual well-being demands a strong and deep public culture. Individual choice will always be a central defining value in any liberal society, but it's impoverished if the common culture contains few goods that are worth pursuing or choosing, and if many people's choices are dominated by the necessities of sheer economic survival. The old left, like the New Right, allowed ideology to cloud its view of vital human needs. Just as the New Right thinks of markets not as tools for meeting human needs, but as ends in themselves, so the old left saw collective provision through the institutions of the state as being somehow intrinsically virtuous. The truth is that both markets and public services are instruments or tools, means, not things to be valued for their own sakes. The old left's ideological commitment to collective provision through the state does not always serve human needs today. It belongs to the past, not to the present or to the future. Abandoning these old polarities is not a shift to the right. It is a move, I think, onto a new common ground. When centre-left thinkers, such as Anthony Giddens and others, acknowledge today that one nation Tory thinking was concerned with vital human needs, they are not for a moment imagining that old-fashioned conservatism contains any answers to the questions we are asking today. In my judgment, conservatism as a coherent philosophy or a coherent strategy of action is no longer a real historical option in Britain. Its social and cultural foundations have been demolished, partly by the economic changes that the New Right has promoted or reinforced. The authority of tradition has been largely destroyed. The social hierarchies and class structures of earlier times have gone. The old order has been torn down, but nothing has been built up to replace it. What thinkers on the centre-left are saying today is that the human needs which traditional conservatism met have not diminished in importance just because Tories have lost interest in them. We should aim to meet them, however, in ways that do not attempt an impossible return to the past. Concern for community is not nostalgia for an irrecoverable past. Perhaps it is true that generations ago, some communities had virtues that are weak or lacking amongst us today. But these communities rested upon hierarchies that are not defensible. They excluded women and minorities from opportunity and voice. They demanded sacrifices of individual autonomy that are insupportable and unacceptable to us. We cannot resurrect those vanished communities, and we should not try. Our task must be instead to meet enduring human needs in new ways. I don't think we can do this by trying to salvage the social democratic policies of a generation or a decade ago. The world has changed too much. The collapse of the Soviet system, economic reforms in China, and the entry into world markets of billions of people who during the Cold War were shut out of them. The continuing economic development of the Asian tigers. The new global mobility of capital and production. These new realities entirely preclude any reversion to social democracy as that was known in the post-war period. They exemplify a movement of economic globalization whose further advance is inexorable. In this new historical context, which an incoming Labour government and a new centre-left project will confront, social democratic values cannot be advanced by trying to conserve the social democratic inheritance of 20 years ago. In our time, social democratic values can be advanced only by modernizing social democracy itself. A modern social democracy will not have to choose between economic efficiency and social cohesion. It will be based on what I take to be the ethical and political reality that economic success and social stability go together. They're partners, not rivals. It will aim to harness market forces in the service of human needs and ambitions. It will see individual autonomy and strong communities as mutually supporting and not as conflicting goods. It will recognize that the competition between economic and social goods, on which the new right based its policies, is not a necessary or a fundamental truth. It's an artifact of incompetent and doctrinaire policies. A modern social democracy will not deny that hard choices will have to be made. In the world that a centre-left government will inherit, there will be harsh and sometimes painful conflicts between claims for each of which there is a powerful argument. A modern social democratic government will need to be able to justify to the public the collective choices it makes between these equally valid goods. Here, fiscal prudence will be crucially important, but economic reasoning will only go so far in resolving difficult ethical dilemmas. Such unavoidable collective choices must be debated and justified in straightforward ethical terms. They should not be masked in the jargon of dated ideologies. A government that holds itself to account in this way will, I think, have a legitimacy that the doctrinaires of the old left and the new right never had. It will be re-elected for a second and hopefully a third term because voters will know that it has made a deep and lasting difference to their lives and well-being. Let me echo what Lord Jenkins has said and remind you all that the new right has not given up the fight. It has lost the battle of ideas. It is a chaos of factions. Like the Conservative Party itself, it's defensive, divided, and sectarian. But it is in no way reconciled to defeat. At present, it is trying to salvage its position by recourse to nationalism. It believes that it has found in European institutions an enemy to replace the one it has lost, the old left enemy that modernization has made irrelevant. It preaches the absurd idea that the British national interest can be defended by a policy of isolation, a policy whose ultimate outcome can only be withdrawal from the European Union. At the same time, the Conservatives have launched themselves on a quixotic crusade in defense of the immobility of the British Constitution. They pass over the fact that the British Constitution that the Tories inherited in 1979 exists no more. It is now barely an historical memory. It's been deformed out of recognition by the centralization of political power. That's an integral part of new right economic policies. The British constitution today is an unbalanced constitution. It cannot survive a conservative electoral defeat. On neither of these two issues does the Conservative Party speak to the mood of the nation. It's not, in fact, addressing the nation. It's talking to itself. But the issues of Europe and of constitutional reform remain of transcendental importance. How they are managed will shape Britain's future. Britain cannot advance whilst it's burdened with a deformed and unbalanced constitution and a relationship of suspicion and hostility with our European partners. Clearing away these inheritances of the new right is not the preserve of any one party. It is the task of all who share liberal and social democratic values. We've come together today as people who share these common values. We're all committed to social cohesion, personal liberty, equal opportunity, and accountable government. We reject both the narrow individualism of the new right and the levelling collectivism of the old left. But the place we occupy is not, I think, a halfway house between rival extremes. Our position is not a compromise between two discredited ideologies. It's a stand on a new common ground. This common ground is fertile soil, I hope and think, for a new radical centre-left project. We don't, of course, agree on every policy or share all our ideas. But the policies and ideas we'll discuss and debate today all have a single common root. They are rooted in the needs and hopes of Britain's underlying progressive majority. In the era which is closing, that majority was silent and powerless. In the era that's now beginning, our task will be to give it voice and power.
Well, your appreciation is clear to our speakers. Those two keynote addresses have created the crucial springboard for our debates during this day. Can I thank you both? And can I now introduce to you our third keynote speaker, Tony Blair, the leader of the Labour Party.
Thank you very much, Elena, and thank you for inviting me to be here at the Passing the Torch conference. And it's a real pleasure to be addressing a conference where I'm not likely to have Michael Heseltine bursting through the door. Perhaps shouldn't speak too soon, but anyway, don't worry, I'm going to avoid personal attacks today. I'm leaving that to Norman Tebbit. To be honest about it, I thought, you know, to call Michael Heseltine tacky, tasteless, and opportunistic, I mean, this is not the Michael Heseltine we know. Anyway, enough of that. I'm also particularly delighted, I may say, to be here at a conference where there's so many distinguished speakers and where Walter Veltroni is also addressing the conference. I can tell you made a very great impression at the Labour Party conference when he came there a short time ago and addressed us. And I've often distributed his speech to other people following our conference and said, you know, don't think it's just happening here, it's happening all over the place. The idea of rethinking the great movement for change all over Europe and indeed the Western world. I'd also, if I may, like to applaud the great energy that has gone into organising this conference and to praise particularly Nexus, Britain's first virtual think tank. I find the people in Nexus frighteningly young myself, which is probably a good thing for me. But I think one of the things that they have succeeded in doing is trying to bring together people from all different walks of life, from all political parties and none, but who share the same basic common aims and objectives. And that is something that we should be very proud of. I promise you I'll only mention Wirral South briefly. When I was up in Wales yesterday, I got asked the classic question from the local journalist, who, as I was coming into the conference hall, said to me, "Tell me, Mr. Blair, are you pleased to have won Wirral South?" Just for one of these, for a moment there, it would be just nice to sort of say, no, I really have preferred to see the Tories get it, but then... great, I didn't, I promise. We had a great victory there, and it was not just a victory for the Labour Party, but I hope it was, too, a comprehensive defeat for the idea that politics can be won and elections can be won simply on the basis of negative campaigning. The Conservatives tried that in Wirral and lost. And we fought a positive campaign and won. And I think that is a great thing for politics. I do believe that people want a government that is confident and that is not afraid to listen to new ideas wherever they come from. They would like the British people to have a different era of politics open up before them, where issues are debated on their merits and where politicians at least try to address the issues of the national interest. Now, I believe that it is possible that we are poised to enter a new era of politics in Britain. I want the Labour Party to be a great, modern, progressive force in British politics, a broad movement for progress and justice with appeal across the classes, where people from all walks of life feel at home and comfortable because they share the same values and priorities for our country. I should say to you and stress, as we always do, we take nothing for granted. The election is not won until it is won. But it is possible, at least, to see the shape of things to come, to see the hope that a new Labour government could be a grand reforming government of the future. A government that is built on the centre ground, that moves beyond the sterile divisions of old left and new right, but isn't some sloppy consensus of the lowest common denominator, but is a genuine radical centre, taking on the great causes, the new causes, that face all modern democracies. And I want it to be a politics of a different style and culture, that works in partnership with people, and that creates a new coalition of support to meet the critical challenges of our time. We seek a politics that is not tribal, but actually seeks to persuade others to join us. It is the Labour Party today that I believe increasingly is a value-driven party, but also a practical party. And it is the Conservative Party, curiously, that has now become a party of ideologues of the extremes. We can draw strength, however, from the fact in trying to build this new broad coalition of support, we're not alone. And that's one of the things that I think is so important about this conference today. The changes that we are trying to address are changes that are happening literally the world over. Throughout Europe, socialists and social democrats are leading the political response to a different type of world. They've abandoned what Willy Brandt once called the theology of the final goal, that is the sort of socialist end of history defined by public ownership and the triumph of the working class. In place, they're putting values upon which politics are based and policies that are practically secured to make those values a reality in practice. So, for example, in Italy, the PDS says that the state should do less but enable more. In Holland, Wim Kok's government has cut unemployment to 6% by reforming the welfare state, and it is the Dutch government that is moving to create a more flexible labour market and use skills and technology to increase the employability of people within that labour market. In Sweden and Norway, the delivery of social benefits as well as social services is being decentralised, and public-private partnerships are being brought into being to address long-term pensions funding. The Portuguese socialist government is mobilising the country's banks to lend to small and medium-sized businesses and people trying to start out as entrepreneurs as part of what they call new socialist philosophy. In Austria, the Social Democratic Party has moved to embrace the dynamism of small-scale private enterprise, supported this time by local government. The same in Denmark, in Finland, in Spain, where parties are undergoing a period of reassessment, confident in their values, but acknowledging that those values have to be translated in a world of rapid change. And what is interesting too, and I suppose I should say this particularly in the presence of, I think, the one Labour Chancellor, indeed the one Chancellor since the war who left office with a balanced budget. There you are. That all those parties are the parties of prudent public finance as well, and often trying to sort out the mess left by previous right-wing governments that talked a great game about how they would control public spending, but in the end did not do so. There's change outside Europe as well. President Clinton's economic record has established the Democrats as the party of competent economic management, and he's taken the lead on education and reinventing government and the labour market. Right across the world, there is a different centre and centre-left agenda being forged. Now, the organisational changes that we have made in the Labour Party have been designed to reinforce our ability to take on that new and different agenda. We have to face the fact, as a political party, that for four elections, the voters did not place their trust in the Labour Party. But I've never believed that our values have been the problem. The problem was that we increasingly seemed out of time to apply those values to the world around us, that we'd failed to distinguish between the goals and objectives that we had and the means of implementing them. The goals and objectives remain the same. The means of implementation vary and should vary from each succeeding generation. We've made those organisational changes, and we've made ideological changes too. We recognise the global economy. We recognise too that the centralised state can become a vested interest just as much as private institutions of wealth and capital. We want to see successful profit-making companies, but believe there's no inconsistency in that and decent standards of fairness for people at work. We've taken seriously the challenge of environmental concern. So like all these parties round the world, we are trying to apply our values, traditional values, to the modern setting. And that changing world, we should be the people that define the nature of that change and the challenge that it brings. In a global economy, $1 trillion a day traded on international currency markets. Some of the world's multinationals have budgets bigger than some governments. Exchange controls and capital controls have been abolished. They're not going to come back. So we live in this extraordinary global economy where money can be traded across frontiers very quickly and where, more than ever before, there is an interdependence in macroeconomic policy. Then changes in computing and communications technology are transforming our culture and society. 40% of families with children have access to up-to-date PCs. 10 years ago, we had 3 TV channels. Soon we will have 200, possibly more. These are changes that are making a massive difference to the way that people lead their lives, the way they receive information, and the way that they work. The adult life cycle no longer corresponds to the model of beverage. Education needs to go on throughout life. Women are working and are gaining 80% of the new jobs. Some people are working into their 70s, whilst for others, they can't get work in their 40s. So we need to rethink many of the central questions that confront us. And of course, we are also confronted, partly as a result of the economic change, but partly as a result of other changes too, with a massive change in the type of society in which we live. Social breakdown, family instability, a large number of people cut off, excluded from society's mainstream, often without any hope or opportunity in our society. All around us, massive economic, technological, and social change. The debate about tax and spending has been transformed. And here is a government in our country today that is spending more on welfare, less on defence, that's doubled the national debt, that's had £130 billion of North Sea oil money, massive amounts of privatisation receipts, and yet has imposed the biggest tax hike in peacetime history. In fact, this government is spending more than under the last Labour government, with higher taxes, but they are getting less for it. Poverty is up, unemployment is up, crime is up, low pay up, and yet more tax and spending. Now, what that means is that we have to ask far more fundamental questions about the composition of taxation and expenditure and the way that we're organising public spending in our country. As a result, therefore, of all these changes, being confronted the world over, a different type of agenda is happening. And perhaps it's difficult sometimes for us to see this, particularly when we're involved in the day-to-day business of politics. But I think that you can see, not just here, but in the United States and in the rest of Europe, there is slowly a gathering momentum behind the idea that there is a different type of agenda in politics that is being defined today. And what is so important about conferences such as this, and the people that are here and are engaged in this debate, is that we seek to define this upon terms that assist the causes of progress and justice that we want to see fulfilled. You see, what I believe is happening is that a new agenda for centre and centre-left parties is emerging. It's not about whether we have a market economy, or how we increase the power of state, or to do with battles between public and private sector. It is to do with how we progress those values that we have in a way that addresses these new problems. What type of things, therefore, are on that agenda? The modernization of the welfare state, not how we increase tax and spending, but how we redesign a welfare state from first principles that uses the money we spend wisely, because at the moment, the welfare state is neither assisting poverty, nor is it actually providing a platform of opportunity for those that become without work. Education is increasingly today now an economic goal, not just a social goal, and it's not just about improving schools, it's about education and learning throughout life, and that requires a quite different approach from government to funding, to how it organises the education system, and to how government works in partnership with the private sector to achieve this. It means, and this is difficult for some people on the left, but I believe is essential, it means that we raise the questions about support for family life, the understanding that strong communities can only be founded on strong families, and that to accept this is not neoconservative, it is actually an essential requirement of meeting the challenges of modern society. It is about also the development and use of new technology. I said that 40% of families had children that had access to up-to-date PCs. That means 60% don't. There is a risk in this new age that we end up with information haves and have-nots, and so another sector of division opens up before us. Care for the environment, the obligation to pass on an environment that is protected, possibly enhanced for the next generation. That is, if you like, a new agenda that has opened up recently, where it is important, in my view, that we have a dialogue with those people that are concerned for the environment, not allowing single interest groups to write the policies of government, but recognising that in raising these concerns, they are raising concerns that are real and genuine and have an impact on the lives of people in our society today. Building tolerance and respect within communities, breaking down racism and other prejudices. Now, that, again, is a different agenda from the agenda people would have had if they'd had a conference like this maybe 50, 60 years ago, but it's real and it's there and we must tackle it. Changes in working practices. We have to be flexible in the modern labour markets. Again, there's no point in thinking that that is a conservative view. It isn't. It is a sensible recognition of the fact that you won't have jobs for life, 9-to-5 working, in the same way that we've had before. But our task is how you improve that flexibility whilst maintaining decent standards of fair treatment at the workplace, and how you allow more people to have the freedom so that flexibility is not just a weapon their employers use against them, but it's something in their own hands that can help them lead better and more fulfilled lives. Reform of government, again, a big objective for the centre and centre-left today. Recognising that this is an era where big centralised government should actually do less, and where the private sector, the voluntary sector, very important now, and it should be working in partnership with a decentralised public sector to try and do more. And sometimes they will do it far more efficiently than government. And we should have no ideological barrier to that. On the contrary, we should be trying to break down the ideological barriers that separate the relationship between public, private and voluntary sectors and the way that they work together. And of course, one other thing that I think is tremendously important that will colour British politics certainly for the next 20, 30 years, possibly even more, and that is defining the nation's place in the world. How we oppose isolationism and some narrow chauvinistic nationalism and build a clear view of how each nation retains its independence and its respect but in a world where nations are going to want to cooperate much more closely together. So these are the types of issues. This is the type of different agenda, if you like, that is being fashioned, not just here in Britain, but all over. People are trying to come together and work out common approaches and solutions to these problems of our modern economies and societies. Now, we have tried, over the past couple of months, to take out from that five key modernising tasks built around those values of progress and justice. Of course, it will be subject to the usual political misconstruction. I mean, if I may just digress for one moment, I think that after the Prime Minister's remarks last night, once again, more lies and more tax lies about the Labour Party. The public is entitled to ask, has the Conservative Party not learned any lesson from the by-election defeat? Will they not even pause now to reflect and listen to the electorate with some humility? I believe that positive policies are gaining understanding and support in all walks of life throughout Britain. And whatever the Conservatives do in negative campaigning, we will carry on putting positive proposals from now until election day. And today I can say to you that as part of those key modernising tasks, our practical plans for tackling youth and long-term unemployment are now well advanced, ready for implementation early in government. We simply cannot continue with a situation where 20% of working-age families have no one in work and where the other 80% have to finance them and often live with the causes of social decay that arise from it. We simply cannot continue with the situation where today unemployment costs this country more than education. And the real nightmare is not the nightmare Mr. Major described. The real nightmare is a Conservative fifth term nightmare where a Tory... real nightmare is the Conservative fifth Tory term, where we create increasingly in our society a group of people shut out, an underclass if you like, shut out of hope and opportunity, the ability to get employment and become decent, proper citizens in our society, and where the rest of us simply have to pay the bills for that social despair. That is why the Shadow Chancellor is now chairing Labour's Welfare to Work Committee, which in government will implement the detailed plans that he and David Blunkett have drawn up to get, as a beginning, 250,000 young people off welfare and into work. And all our departments, Treasury, Education and Employment, Social Security, Environment in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, should be working on an interdepartmental basis for a common aim that every young person leaves school and goes into proper training or work. For today's school leavers, there will be, and there should be, no lifetime on the dole. Every young person should get the chance of proper education or a proper job when they leave school. So early on, in the early budget from the Chancellor, that early budget will be the welfare to work budget. The Treasury introducing the first stage of our modernisation programme for the welfare state. And the purpose of that programme is not to raise public spending, not some hidden public spending plan as the Conservatives have it, but it is to reduce public spending on unemployment, to end the absurd situation where we spend more on the costs of unemployment and social decay than we do on educating our children for the future. No civilised society should remain in that state. And a windfall levy today can therefore cut the bills of social security tomorrow. And these proposals, practical and detailed, include work with a private employer who will be paid a £60 tax rebate, a tax cut if you like, for businesses to provide a job and a chance for a young person. The options also include work with a new environmental task force that will engage young people's concerns about the environment, or for the unskilled, full-time training for a qualification. The four options will be managed through a new and revitalised employment service run from the Department of Education and Employment,
and our Welfare to Work programme will begin a programme of action to tackle the second great waste, not just youth unemployment, but long-term unemployment amongst adult men and women. Our aim, again, over the Parliament, will be to offer the long-term unemployed work. The choices will include a job with an employer who will receive a tax rebate of £75 a week and work with a community programme. As with young people, there will be a range of options, but as with young people, we will expect responsibility in return for opportunity. So I can say today that for the long-term unemployed, turning down all choices and staying on benefit, doing nothing, will not be an option either. Because we believe, unlike the Tories, in offering people opportunity, in reducing this burden of long-term unemployment, we believe we are entitled to demand responsibility in return. The second great task, after modernisation of the welfare state, and indeed running in parallel with it, is to ensure that every school is good or improving, every adult with learning opportunities throughout life. Again, we have put forward detailed and practical proposals for nursery provision, for smaller class sizes, for year-on-year targets for school improvement, for getting computers into our schools, a general teaching council, reform of teacher training, a broader A-levels, the funding of higher education being made fair and efficient, a university for industry, and many more. Already, we are trying to focus the education debate around standards rather than structures and on learning throughout life, not merely improving education within schools. Thirdly, for us it is a priority to build a new and modern relationship between government and business. Partners for the country's success. Flexibility, yes, but flexibility plus. Flexibility plus high skills, plus proper infrastructure, plus support for small businesses, plus fair standards at work, plus support for the environment and family-friendly working. Now, that is the way to create an economy which is competitive and successful, but also just. Fourthly, we will take on the task of devolving and decentralising power. I don't believe the Conservatives are simply wrong on this issue. I think increasingly they are ridiculous. Now, we have the most over-centralised government anywhere in the Western world. And the idea that we can't decentralise it... the idea that we cannot decentralise it is simply absurd. And we can, and we will. And I believe that we will do it with the vast support of the vast majority of people. And we will end the situation too, where in this country today we actually have more money being spent by unelected, unaccountable quangos than we do by elected local government. I mean, there can be nothing more ridiculous than that. And we will begin the process, too, of reforming the situation where elderly people in the House of Lords are making policy on the basis of hereditary peerages. That cannot possibly be right in any democratic... in any democratic society. I also believe, however, that there is a fifth task as well. We also want Britain to get the best out of Europe for Britain. Growing numbers of Conservatives now openly support withdrawal from Europe. We have three options. We can either become out of Europe altogether, which will be a disaster for British jobs and investment and industry, or we can carry on as we are under this government, in but impotent, unable to make any progress in Europe, or we can be in, but trying to set an agenda for reform and change. Of course Europe needs reform and change. We aren't satisfied with the way it is developing. Many people in Europe, in the rest of Europe, in continental Europe, aren't satisfied. But we will only be able to give a lead and take part in shaping reform if we are seen to be constructive and engaged, and if we are seen to be doing so on the basis of a positive and sensible attitude to our relations with the rest of Europe. And that we will do, shaping the future of Europe to secure reform and a good deal for Britain. So those, if you like, are out of the challenges that we face, the five challenges that we pick out particularly. Modernising the welfare state, improving schools, but also improving learning throughout life, making sure we have a dynamic partnership with business and industry to give ourselves the industrial base of the future. Decentralising power, getting power out of Whitehall and Westminster back into the hands of people, and getting the best for Britain out of Europe. Now, this is an agenda for change and an agenda that I believe that we can implement. It is based on traditional, basic, good, centre-left values, but it is applying them to a different world. There have been two great reforming governments in Britain this century, 1906, 1945. They both developed a body of ideas that swept the Conservatives aside. They both engineered major social, economic, and political reform. They are, if you like, for this century, the defining moments of our radical heritage. We must build now a new coalition with the people to get behind a new era of change. It's not a matter of constructing deals amongst politicians or pacts between parties. We want governments to lead change. And for that to happen, those governments need roots, deep roots. We are not engaged in a cultural revolution, redesigning society from the top down according to a blueprint. We are taking a living, breathing nation and trying to build on its strengths. Our task is to unify, not divide, to reach across old boundaries, not just to seek new support, but to build change. And over this next period of time, of course it will be difficult. People will always want us to go faster. They will always want us to achieve more. There will always be the cries that we're too cautious, we should do this, we should do that. And we recognize that. And we recognize the impatience that there is for change and reform. But it is important now that we recognize that we have actually properly and intellectually defined the challenges for the future. We have properly defined the notion of change within society and the economy, and we have drawn up the right agenda for action in government. Now, exactly how all those changes will take place, how all the T's are crossed and the I's dotted, not all of that will be able to be done from the standpoint of opposition. But the compass is set clear. We know what it is that we want to achieve, and we know what are the values that are driving that achievement. And we've actually set forward probably more opposition policy than any opposition has ever done, although it's never enough for people, and quite right too. But after 18 years of Conservative government, we have to recognise that it's best to start out responsibly with step-by-step reform than attempt to do everything at once in some grand 100 days of government vision and then end up achieving nothing very much at all. I ask you to join that movement for reform, for progress and justice. There is much work to be done, but we are open to new ideas that can help us achieve it more practically. If we are elected, it will not be a government of a narrow, self-satisfied clique that arrogantly assumes it knows all the answers. It will be firmly led from the centre ground, but it will be radical. And there are new possibilities opening up. The very fact that we are having a conference like this today, so many people have come from so many different parts of the political spectrum, but genuinely believing that it is possible that the torch is being passed on, that finally, the long days of exclusion for people that believe in our values is coming to an end, and a new era of hope is being opened up. It should be a time of excitement, realistic, hard-headed, but still passionate about the possibilities. So I simply say to you this by way of conclusion. Don't let the cynics win. The only people that ever gain from cynicism are Conservatives. It's absolutely true, you know. The only people that ever gain are Tories. It's when, like when people tell you it makes no difference, you know. They're all the same, the politicians. The Tories know it makes a difference. That's why they've been in power for 18 years. Yeah. It will make a difference. And it will make a difference in part because of the people here today. Your energy, your ideas and commitment, as well as ours. Together, I believe that we can do it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, James. Thank you, James.
Well, that is the close of this session. Can I thank all of our keynote speakers, and can I ask you to have a very good day, enjoy it, feel motivated, and go out there feeling optimistic about change.